doubly betrayed because of what Donald said next. Jim, I think your poem is too good to be true. Frankly, I don't think you wrote it. Practically speaking, Jim may have been mute, but his hearing was excellent. He couldn't believe his ears. Mr. Crouch was accusing him of plagiarism? If the words really are yours, Jim, then prove it. Stand and recite them right now, or admit you stole them. Jim sprung to his feet and recited Ode to a Grapefruit, just as he had written it. There was anger in his voice, but what a voice it turned out to be. Big and booming and clear as a bell. That was the day Donald Crouch unlocked one of the most powerful and familiar voices in the world, the voice of a boy who stuttered whenever he read aloud, but not when he recited from memory. As Robert Frost put it, way leads onto way, and Jim's way was suddenly clear. He became a master of memorization. Reciting poetry led to the debate club. Debate club led to the theater. In time, Jim's newfound vocal prowess took him all the way to Broadway, where he was cast as the lead in Shakespeare's Othello. A big part, but one that he memorized in no time at all. A Tony Award followed, then an Emmy, then an honorary Oscar. The world, it seemed, was too small to contain a voice as big as Jim's. And so, Jim took on the galaxy. A galaxy far, far away. That's how the villainous voice of Darth Vader was created, coaxed from the body of a tremendous performer who might have remained a more silent observer, if not for the extraordinary teacher who understood the power of the spoken word and the unexpected arrival of a ruby red grapefruit that tasted too good to be true, the unmistakable voice of James Earl Jones. Like James Earl Jones, I was a painfully shy kid with a deep voice and a weird stammer. My mother still likes to tell stories of how, as a boy, I'd dive under the dining room table when the doorbell rang. Sometimes, according to her, I would vomit at the mere prospect of meeting new people. Happily, the Boy Scouts were on hand to help me out of my shell, along with a teacher no less remarkable than Donald Crouch, my favorite teacher, Fred King. I was a tall, skinny freshman when we first met, with an encroaching hairline and a larynx the size of a fist. He was Mr. King, the new music teacher who inherited a choir filled with students like me, students who'd never sung before and thought they were getting a free period. From the start, we got much more than we bargained for. Remember George C. Scott's opening speech in Patton? Well, Patton was a wimp compared to Fred King. He walked into our classroom that very first day and greeted us with two words that bled into each other.
Shut up!
His voice was stunningly loud. The classroom was instantly quiet. In the silence, he passed out a piece of sheet music far beyond anyone's ability to sight read. It was a 6-part a cappella arrangement in Latin. There was no way for us to get our bearings. We didn't know how to sight read, and what's more, there was no time. Mr. King had already blown a pitch pipe, raised his hands, and started to conduct. I don't know what he was expecting, but the silence that followed seemed to confuse him. Mr. King looked around curiously. He looked at his hands as if they were causing the problem. Then he frowned, gave us the pitch one more time, and started conducting again. Silence. This is the Overly High School Concert Choir, is it not? Once again, silence. Mr. King closed his eyes. He took several deep breaths, as though trying to calm himself. Then he came unhinged. Smashing one hand on the piano, he launched into a tirade peppered with expressions most often heard in pool halls and saloons. He foamed. He raved. He cursed like the sailor he had once been as the veins bulged in his neck and forehead. He tore the sheet music to shreds, threw the pieces into the air, and started to rant about cruel twists of fate, clueless mutes, and a few other things. Kicking a music stand across the classroom, he bellowed, "If you're not willing to sing, then get the hell out!" A phenomenal exodus followed. Half the class bolted and never looked back. I might have joined them, but I had become paralyzed. Who was this lunatic? I was still sitting, dumbfounded, when Mr. King slammed the door shut, popped something into his mouth, and walked back to the piano, glaring at those who had dared remain. For a long while he stood there, breathing deeply, to get himself under control. Then, his face cracked in half. Technically, one might describe what we saw as a smile. I would describe it as more of a gash, a cruel opening between nose and chin, revealing a rictus of rotten enamel. Tiny teeth, baby teeth, were crowded up against giant incisors. Molars sprouted from spots normally reserved for canines. His front teeth, though properly placed, were the size of small thumbs. They jutted past his ever-widening lips as if they were trying to escape the diseased gums from which they hung. Beth Johnson gasped. Cindy Stone screamed. We all recoiled from the dental disaster, and only when we had collected ourselves did Mr. King remove the hideous choppers from his mouth and replace them with human-looking dentures. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "the cowards have all departed. Let's have some fun." For the next 3 years, that's exactly what we did. We talked, we laughed, we learned. We marveled at all the false teeth, a grotesque collection designed by a dentist whose sense of humor was no less twisted than Mr. King's own. We learned that our teacher's real teeth had been knocked out years earlier on the gridiron. Yet we continued to marvel. You never knew what Mr. King had in his mouth, and you never knew what would come out of it. With no regard for the standard curriculum, without a shred of political correctness, Mr. King went about the business of spurring, exhorting, and inspiring his students. Instructing is too weak a word. He pushed us as no other teacher had dared. He'd give us Vaughan Williams' Hodier and Bach's Mass in B minor to sing, works so far beyond our ability, we didn't know any better than to try them. And so we sang those works, and many others. "What, not how," that's what he'd say. "Always concentrate on what you're doing, never how." It was a valuable lesson, a lesson that I would forget more than once. Hell, you just heard me forget it a couple of pages ago up on the Mackinac Bridge, but a valuable one, nevertheless. Anyway, as I was saying, I confessed to Mr. King early on, "I've never sung before." In response, he assigned me a solo, one that was several notes out of my range. He kept me after class for private voice lessons, and when he saw that I stuttered, he suggested that I audition for the school play. By suggested, I mean to say he demanded, and the results were disastrous. Alone on the stage of our school's auditorium, I was stammering my way through a monologue memorized the night before when Mr. King interrupted me. "Mikey," he said, "I like what you're doing, but this character doesn't stutter. You understand? Get into the character. What, not how. You can stutter on your own time." I didn't think or resist. I didn't argue. I just started over. And this time, I didn't stutter. A light bulb went off. New possibilities opened before me. I started to act like a non-stuttering person, a more confident person, a person who might, with a little luck, one day explain how the universe works, or sing arias from Puccini, or sell tchotchkes on live TV, or pickups for Ford, or become marginally famous for gathering sperm from racehorses on primetime TV. For the moment, I'd settle for the lead in one of our school plays, and a new place in Fred King's mighty Chorus of the Chesapeake. From there, I'd play things as they lay, and try to remember the virtues of what, not how. A simple thing, really, that turned out to be a lot harder than it sounded. Chapter 28. Keep your voice down. Bob had a voice like a jackhammer, and when he raised it, recruits in the barracks at Eielson Air Force Base awakened as though a shotgun had been fired over their heads. Rise and shine, dirtbags! Everybody up! Everybody out! Let's move it! As the young men sprang from their bunks, it occurred to Bob that he'd been yelling at recruits for as long as he'd been getting crew cuts. The work of a master sergeant in the Air Force, Bob's job description, basically, came down to yelling. Come on, ladies, we're not on vacation. Let's get the lead out! As the airmen prepared for yet another 5-mile run, Bob looked through the frosted window panes of the drafty barracks and watched yet another sunrise light up the snow-capped mountains behind Moose Creek, the early morning rays illuminating the distant clouds, the mighty fir trees standing along the riverbank like emerald sentinels, the massive boulder in the middle of the rushing stream where the grizzly bears perched, waiting for the salmon on their way to spawn. As always, Bob paused to let the image burn itself into his mind's eye. Then he did something rather unusual. He quit. At 38 years of age, the master sergeant vowed right then and there to leave the Air Force, stop yelling, and get out of the cold. And that is how Bob became a famous TV star. Actually, it wasn't as easy as all that. It never is. Bob had no experience in front of the camera, and his road to stardom was paved, as such roads often are, with rejection and frustration. But Bob also caught one lucky break, a very lucky break, in the form of Annette Kowalski, who first saw him perform in a workshop in Clearwater, Florida. Years later, she recalled their first meeting. I was in a deep depression, she said, grieving the tragic loss of my oldest son. Watching Bob perform changed everything. It wasn't just his talent. It was the way he made me feel. He just lifted my spirits and radiated a quality that I knew America was starving for. Annette wasn't an agent or a manager, but she knew what talent was when she saw it. So she proposed a business relationship. Bob agreed, and in less than a year, not only did the retired Master Sergeant have a hit show, he had the number one program on the channel. Eventually, he had a body of work that all but eclipsed anyone else's, with 400 episodes under his belt. And that was how Bob became a famous TV star. Actually, it wasn't as easy as all that. It never is. Annette had no experience managing talent or selling TV shows. She waded through countless no's before finding a station manager in Virginia who was willing to put Bob on the air. Once that happened, it really was as easy as that, because Annette had been right all along. Bob had a certain quality Americans seemed to be starving for. Funny thing, though, in an NPR interview in 2016, 20 years after Bob's untimely death at the age of 52, Annette described Bob in a way that shocked listeners. She called him a tyrant. You don't believe that? She asked. Do you really think this company would be as successful as it is if he didn't insist that everything be done a certain way? The interviewer was speechless. I don't want to leave the impression that he was rude or nasty, Annette added. He wasn't, but he was very disciplined, very strict. Believe me, it was Bob's way, or no way at all. NPR's audience might have been surprised by Annette's frank assessment. That wasn't how they pictured Bob being at all. But if any of Bob's old recruits had been listening, they wouldn't have batted an eye. Oh, no. Tyrants would have summed up their former master sergeant nicely. Then again, imagine the shock they had gotten years earlier, when the man with the crew cut, who'd screamed at them around the clock had suddenly popped up on their TV screens with an afro the size of a beach ball and started whispering in a voice so soft you could call it soporific about fluffy little clouds, happy little trees, and friendly little boulders to help Mr. Grizzly catch his lunch in our busy little stream. They would have found it confusing. Yet their sergeant was the very same man Annette Kowalski had discovered in Clearwater, Florida, giving painting lessons to strangers in a hotel conference room. The soft-spoken art teacher who communicated primarily with dashes of titanium white, smidges of cadmium yellow, and touches of Van Dyke brown. Such was the color palette of the man who pulled Annette Kowalski from the depths of her crippling depression, the man who lulled millions of viewers into a hypnotic stupor every week on PBS, the master sergeant who'd let his hair grow out and vowed to never again raise his voice. You might not know him by name, but I bet you've seen The Joy of Painting, a little program that lives on forever in reruns, thanks to a man who spent the first part of his life screaming at thousands of recruits in the Air Force, and the rest of it whispering ever so gently to millions of mesmerized viewers. A beloved artist named Bob Ross. Bob Ross wasn't just an artist. He was a magician. A magician who could turn a blank canvas into a primeval forest or an angry ocean right before our eyes. His secret? There was no secret. Bob Ross worked without a net. He showed us exactly what he was doing, and in the process, gave me and millions of other viewers the opportunity to follow along, step by step. Odd thing, though, whenever I tried to paint my own happy little bushes, the results were neither happy nor bushy. Odd, because the artistic gene runs in my family. My grandmother's sister, Betty, was a terrific painter. So too was my cousin, Nancy. She didn't start till she was in her 50s, but once she discovered her talent, she never put down the brush. Several of her paintings hang in my home today. To my eye, they're every bit as good as anything I've ever seen on The Joy of Painting. But, without question, the most skilled artist in my family was an industrial artist, my grandfather, Carl Noble. An electrician by trade, Pop could repair anything. Didn't matter what the it was, a broken watch, a faulty furnace, a busted engine. He would either fix it or build a new one from scratch. Pop never made it past the seventh grade, but he was plenty smart. He was also patient, though I never once saw him read the instructions to anything. He just seemed to know how things worked. When I was still a small boy, my father showed me a bronze plaque in the church we attended, the same church whose basement would become a permanent home for Troop 16. Pop had built much of that church, and the plaque inside it reads, "In honor of Carl M. Noble, humble servant of Jesus Christ, who through the years has given himself to the program of Christian education at the Kenwood Presbyterian Church." Look at that, son. Your grandfather has a plaque in his honor. Who else do you know with a plaque? My grandparents were our next-door neighbors. We had the only two homes at the top of a hill, tucked away in a corner of Baltimore County. Mom and Dad and my brothers and me living no more than 100 yards away from Nana and Pop. There was room for a cornfield, a pasture where Mom kept her horses, and a big garden up by the woodpile. Off to one side, at the foot of a very steep hill thick with pine trees, you could just hear the traffic flowing off an exit ramp from Interstate 95. My mother told us that the sound was the ocean, and for a while there, we believed her, until a truck hopped the guardrail one day and came halfway up the hill. Pop built the stable where Mom housed her horses. He'd built the family room in his own home. We gathered there for every holiday, every birthday, every other occasion worth celebrating. In the summer of 75, when my mother started to feel claustrophobic in our modest farmhouse, my grandfather built her a family room, too, along with the patio. His addition to our house was nearly as big as the house itself had been. Every day that summer, Pop woke up clean and came home dirty. That was his way on any project. He started clean, ended dirty, and somewhere along the way, a thing was built or a problem was solved. But this project was different. This work was magical because it unfolded right in front of my wondering eyes. Where there had been grass, there was suddenly a foundation. Where there had been empty air, there were now walls and a roof. Then there were windows and a fireplace. And then, in a twinkling, the summer was over, and my mom had a family room of her own. I studied Pop's every move on the construction site, determined to follow in his footsteps. I became his apprentice that summer and loved it. Odd thing, though, none of the work we were doing made sense to me, and things were no easier in school. In woodshop, I made a sconce that looked more like an amoeba. Pop nodded when I showed it to him and applauded my creative design. In metal shop, I made a steel safe that didn't quite close. I'd also put the hinges on the wrong side. I got an F, and this time I asked Pop if he thought the handy gene might be recessive. He laughed. There's nothing magical about what I do, Mike. I'm just using the tools I was given. You can be a tradesman, too, if that's what you want to be. Heck, we're all tradesmen. The trick is to get the right toolbox. Was that the best advice Pop ever gave me? That's hard to say, but without question, it was the best advice I ever took. Chapter 29, The Biggest Name in Town. High in the hills of a town without pity, a stubborn sun slowly set on a warm September evening, even as a young starlet walked up the shoulder of some canyon road and out onto the property of the biggest name in town. She was apprehensive, understandably so, partly because it was getting dark, partly because she was trespassing, and partly because she was about to kill someone. For the record, the starlet was not violent by nature, but desperate times called for desperate measures. The studio head, a big man in town, was also a feckless fool without taste or common sense. He had all but cut her out of the film that would have made her famous. Just like that, in the blink of an eye, her long-anticipated debut on the silver screen had been reduced to a pile of celluloid on the cutting room floor. Could she have called HR? Could she have lodged a formal complaint with the studio? No. This betrayal would not be remedied with a hashtag and a Me Too. This was personal. The starlet steeled herself for the task at hand, double-checked the contents of her purse, and approached the sprawling property of the biggest name in town. Five stories above her, the legendary icon looked down as the starlet approached. Her appearance was not exactly a surprise. Beautiful girls often came to this very spot. Usually, they came around sunset. This girl, however, was a real looker. She was 24, flaxen hair, alabaster skin, eyes bluer than a Montana sky. Oh, yes, girls like her were always welcome here. Pretty young things with stars in their eyes, happy to barter everything they had for the one thing they didn't. Five stories below, the starlet was smiling, smiling in spite of her dark purpose. It felt good to fight back. She recalled the role that launched her career, a small but essential part in a Broadway production of Hamlet. At the King's command, in a pivotal scene in Act Five, her uncredited character introduced an all-important poisoned cup, one intended for Hamlet, but consumed accidentally by the king's wife and Hamlet's mother, Gertrude. The starlet recalled that performance so clearly. It was more than worthy of an encore. Of that, she was sure. But enough with the memories. Back to the task at hand. She knew the way in. She knew that her target was on the top floor. In her mind's eye, she saw herself ascending each step carefully, one at a time. Up at the top, the view was sure to be breathtaking. The sun was now beneath the horizon. The lights of Tinseltown would be twinkling all the way out to the Pacific. But she would not be distracted. The role she was playing tonight was that of a cold-blooded killer, and she would play it to the best of her ability. She would betray nothing of her true intentions. She would simply wait till the moment was right, and then she would show the biggest name in town what real power looked like. The starlet checked the contents of her purse one last time. She made sure that everything was exactly where it should be. Then she began her careful climb up to the fifth story, where she delivered a truly Oscar-worthy performance. A hiker found the corpse 3 days later, a mangled body in a nearby ravine. Detectives were called, but you didn't have to be a hard-boiled gumshoe or a Sunset Boulevard Seamus to figure out who done it. The cops knew all about the starlet's abrupt removal from 13 Women, her first and last major motion picture. They knew all about the financial difficulties that followed, along with the nude photographs for which she had been paid to pose. But it was the contents of her purse that closed the case just moments after it had been opened, specifically a short note that read, "I'm afraid I am a coward. I'm sorry for everything. If I had done this a long time ago, it would have saved a lot of pain." And that's how the curtain fell on the final act of Peg Entwistle, a gifted actress who left a promising career on the stage to try her luck in Los Angeles. Alas, the only performance for which she's remembered today is the one she delivered on that warm September evening back in 1932 at a famous address on the rocky slopes of Mount Lee, high in the hills of a town without pity. It was there, at the end of a canyon road called Beechwood, that poor Peg, her spirit broken by empty promises and shattered dreams, made good on her promise to kill someone by climbing the rungs of a rickety ladder, scrambling onto the top of a giant H, and throwing herself off the Hollywood sign. It was, after all, the biggest name in town. You want to hear a host story? I don't blame you. As the host of cultural touchstones like Worst Case Scenario and How Booze Built America, I'm partial to them myself. But my favorite host story is the one I experienced firsthand at a production company in Burbank back in 1997. Like Peg Entwistle's tale, mine is full of hope and ambition. It, too, involves one of the biggest names in town. Unlike Peg's story, mine has a happy ending, thanks to an excellent piece of advice I still try to follow whenever I'm in front of the camera. I want to share that advice with you because writing about Peg made me wonder where I'd be without the many words of wisdom I've received over the years. Maybe if someone had pulled Peg aside at just the right moment and said just the right thing, she would have gone on to her own long career. Maybe she'd have a star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame. Maybe she'd have written her own book about it. We'll never know, sadly, but what I do know is that way back in 1997, a producer named Tom Frank was looking for a game show host, and my tape must have made an impression. "This is the worst tape I've ever seen," he said. "There's nothing on here but mistakes and outtakes." "Thanks," I said. "I try to manage expectations." "Mission accomplished," he replied. "It made me wonder if you were stable." "You'll have to hire me to find out," I said. "Would you like to hear about the project first?" he asked. "Please," I said. "The anticipation is killing me." Tom Frank talked fast, sounding like all producers do when they explain an idea they've explained 1,000 times to 1,000 people they'll never talk to again. "The show's called No Relation," he said. "The FX channel has just bought 40 episodes." "What's the FX channel?" I asked. "Did Fox lose a vowel?" Tom Frank ignored the question. "The show works like this. On each episode, a celebrity panel attempts to determine which member of a family of five is not related to the other four. In round one, celebrities question the contestants individually. In round two, They question the family together and compare their notes. They make their best guess. Then, the imposter reveals him or herself, and we bring out the actual family member that they've been impersonating. Are there fabulous prizes, I ask? Depends on how many celebrities are fooled. If none of them guess correctly, the imposter gets $1,000 and the family gets an all-expenses-paid trip to Mexico. What do you think? To tell you the truth, I said, it sounds like to tell the truth. Yeah, well, there's no such thing as a new idea. But this is a very big deal for the network. It sounded like a guaranteed failure, which was precisely what I was looking for. It's what I always looked for in those days. A few months of steady work, followed by a quick cancellation, followed by a few months of premature retirement. Perfect. Travis McGee, 101. I'm your man, I said. When do I start? I'm not offering you the job, Tom Frank said. I'm offering you an audition, tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Great. What do game show hosts wear nowadays, I asked. Wear a sport coat, slacks, button-down shirt, no tie. Wouldn't it be easier if you just gave me the job now, I asked. Honestly, I'm not even sure I should give you the address. He did, though, and I arrived 10 minutes early the next morning at an office building in Burbank. A pretty receptionist handed me a script and led me to a conference room where a dozen other guys were pacing around, memorizing the same words, muttering to themselves in the same practice baritones. Button-down shirts, slacks, and sport coats. No ties. We looked like mannequins recently escaped from the same haberdashery. One guy, in particular, was a composite of every game show host I'd ever seen. He had white teeth and a suspicious tan, and seemed so supremely confident that I wondered if he had already gotten the gig. He reminded me of a very young Dick Clark, who was, for my money, the best game show host ever. I love the way Clark leaned against the podium while explaining the rules on the $25,000 pyramid. Not a care in the world. As the stakes increased, he didn't get ramped up. He got more laid back. Dick Clark hosted like Perry Como sang, warm, genuine, with a touch of insouciance. How would Dick Clark have handled no relation? I was the last to be called. On a mock stage, three celebrities sat on a sofa. Their name tags read Tom Hanks, Julia Roberts, and Shelley Long. Five production assistants, who also had name tags, were sitting in folding chairs across from them. They were the Johnsons. At the far end of the room, there was a video camera, a large monitor, and a partition. Behind the camera, in front of the partition, a small group of people huddled and conferred. The suits. Tom Frank was among them. We bantered for a moment. Then Frank said, "Action." And I immediately went off script, channeling my inner Dick Clark. "Hello, everyone, and welcome to No Relation. It's nice to see you all again. I'm Mike Rowe, and these are the Johnsons. Well, at least four of them are. One of them is actually an imposter who has assumed the identity of the missing Johnson who is bound and gagged in the trunk of my car. I'm kidding. The missing Johnson is backstage and will remain there as our celebrity judges question the real Johnsons and find out which one of them is no relation. Before we begin, let's meet our celebrity judges." We pretended to play for 20 minutes or so. At first, I was put off by the fact that Tom Hanks had a mohawk and Julia Roberts looked like my grandmother. The Johnson family was also confusing. The parents were white, the daughter was Asian, the son was black, and the grandmother appeared to be Hispanic, a configuration that added new layers of complexity to the show's central question, but spoke well of the production company's commitment to diversity in the workplace. Nevertheless, I worked through, guiding the conversation, making mild, mostly tasteful jokes, and trying not to look too hard at Shelley Long, who looked and sounded just like Shelley Long, which I found to be doubly distracting. We were rolling along pretty well when Tom Frank said, "Cut," and walked toward me. "Tell me," he said, "is that your lucky jacket?" "Don't know yet," I said. "I borrowed it from a friend." The coat I was wearing belonged to my high school friend, Chuck. on whose couch I'd been crashing in Hollywood. It was electric blue, with a slight bias toward periwinkle. "Does your friend work for the circus?" "Worse," I said. "He sings barbershop." At which point, a really weird thing happened. A shocking thing. Dick Clark stepped out from behind a partition and said, "Hello." Every so often, the universe behaves in ways that leave me mute. This was one such occasion. Had I just conjured Dick Clark out of thin air? Was I seeing some sort of phantom? A ghost? It sure felt that way. One minute, I'd been channeling Dick Clark. Now, here he was, and I couldn't quite square it. "That was great. Really nice work." I was speechless, gobsmacked, flabbergasted. "By the way," the ghost said, "I'm Dick Clark." "That is correct," I replied, as if I were hosting a game show. It really was him. Dick Clark laughed in a completely warm and genuine way. "Welcome to my production company. Thanks for coming by. You're a natural. I've seen some of your work. But tell me, have you hosted a game show before?" "No, I haven't," I said, "but I've done lots of live television." I was hoping he didn't know that I'd been thrown out of the home shopping industry. "Tom tells me you were thrown out of the home shopping industry," Dick Clark said. "What happened?" I cleared my throat and glanced at Tom, who was clearly enjoying the moment. "There was a mutual consensus that my skills were inconsistent with the expectations of that particular genre," I said. Dick Clark laughed again. "I bet you have some great stories." "One or two," I said, as another suit stepped out from behind the partition. "Mike, this is Rich Ross. He calls the shots over at FX. Rich Ross looked a lot younger than I would have expected. "Hi, Mike," he said. "We're big fans over at the network. We'd love to see you again." Dick Clark nodded in agreement. "Can you come back in a few days?" Ross asked. "Sure," I said. Then Dick Clark stepped closer to me and lowered his voice. "Can I give you some advice?" he asked. I thought he was going to comment on Chuck's jacket, that or tell me to stick to the script. But he didn't. Instead, he imparted a secret, a treasured bit of advice that was so obvious and so good, I was certain the moment I heard it, I'd never forget it. I was wrong about that, of course, but it's nice to feel certain every now and again. Chapter 30 Charlie's Big Break. Charlie knew he had a hit the moment he picked up the guitar. The tune seemed to write itself. The words tumbled out of his mouth as though he had known them all his life. Like every other aspiring musician who had come to Los Angeles with stars in his eyes, Charlie needed a break, a chance to show everyone just who he was and what he was capable of. Now, finally, that chance had come. Seated across from him were two major players in the music biz, the legendary drummer who'd befriended him a few weeks earlier, and the legendary producer, a man credited with shaping the California sound. Either man could have made Charlie famous, literally overnight. Charlie stroked the neck of his acoustic guitar, took a deep breath, and began to play. And really, it could not have gone better. The legendary producer nodded in time with the music. The legendary drummer hummed along in harmony. It was the kind of audition every performer dreams of giving, and when the song came to an end, Charlie knew he was a few steps closer to stardom. The legendary drummer said, "Hell yeah." The legendary producer said, "Damn, let's make an album." And so they did. Over the next few weeks, Charlie recorded four original songs. With the help of the legendary drummer and two of his legendary bandmates, Charlie found the magic every famous musician tries to capture in the studio. But the legendary producer had issues with some of the lyrics. He wanted something softer, something more relatable. Like any true artist, Charlie was not inclined to compromise his work. He pushed back. He had something important to say, damn it, and no producer, however legendary, was going to boss him around. Really, who did the guy think he was? These were Charlie's songs, and Charlie would sing them the way he wanted. Long story short, Charlie blew it. He alienated the very people he needed most. The legendary producer stopped taking his calls. The legendary drummer went back to being a rock star. Charlie took it hard and, by all accounts, handled the rejection quite badly. One day, after weeks of being ignored, he confronted the legendary drummer at his home on Sunset Boulevard. He'd brought a gift along, a single bullet. "What's this for?" the legendary drummer asked. "It's for you," said Charlie. "Every time you look at it, I want you to think how nice it is that your kids are still safe." That did it. The legendary drummer was not one to take a threat lightly, especially one directed toward his family. Charlie should have known that. And so the legendary drummer beat Charlie, beat him like the drums he pummeled for a living. Then he threw Charlie to the floor and beat him some more. He beat Charlie until Charlie wept like a baby. But the hardest blow had yet to fall. One year later, a broke, unemployed Charlie was killing time in a record shop. There, he saw a poster of the legendary drummer playing on stage with his legendary brothers. They had a new single out, "Bluebirds Over the Mountains," a cover of an old rockabilly song. "Jesus," said Charlie, "what a bunch of hacks. They don't even write their own songs anymore." The B-side, however, was an original. "Never Learn Not to Love," it was called. Charlie was curious, naturally. He shoplifted the record, and later that night, seconds after dropping the needle on the vinyl, he dropped his beer on the floor and collapsed onto the sofa in a stupefied rage. They had changed the title. They had altered a few of the lyrics, but the rest was identical. It was the same song that he had auditioned with, only now it was being sung by the legendary drummer, Dennis Wilson. No one can say if having his song stolen by the Beach Boys pushed Charlie over the edge, but no one can deny that in the months that followed, Charlie paid a visit to the home of that legendary producer, a man named Terry Melcher. Melcher then moved to Malibu, which was good news for him, but not so good for the new residents of his old home. Those people were all murdered in the most brutal fashion imaginable. Thus began a killing spree that led to the trial of the century and eventually brought Charlie the fame he had so desperately sought. For whatever it's worth, Charlie's audition song had originally been called "Cease to Exist," which Charlie stubbornly refused to do. Long after his legendary drummer and his legendary producer had shuffled off their mortal coils, Charlie sat rotting in his jail cell, waiting for the big break that never seemed to come, until it finally did, 46 years later. A really big break that finally rid the world of a mass murderer named Charles Manson. Never Learn Not to Love. See what the Beach Boys did there? With the judicious deployment of a single double negative, Manson's "Cease to Exist" suddenly sounds a lot less deranged and much more like a Zen koan. That's how Dick Clark's advice had struck me back when I was auditioning to host No Relation. Next time, don't say hello to everyone. I was confounded. What did that mean? My expression conveyed my confusion. "When you looked into the lens," he said, "your first words were, 'Hello, everyone.' That's probably not the best way to say hello." "It's not?" "No. And when you said, 'It's nice to see you all again,' that's also a mistake."
"It is?"
"Yes. People don't see themselves as part of a crowd, Mike. They see themselves as individuals. They want a personal connection with someone they can trust. Your job is to be that person. That's what a good host does. He becomes a guest in the viewer's home." I realized just then that I was still shaking Dick Clark's hand, even though he had stopped shaking mine. I let his go, and he put it on my shoulder. When you talk to the camera, Mike, don't think about everybody. Think about one person, someone you know, someone you like. Talk to them. And if you say, "It's nice to see you again," make damn sure you mean it. "Thanks, Mr. Clark. I'll do that." "You can call me Dick," he said. "All my friends do." The next day, Tom Frank called me back. It had come down to me and that one other guy, the young kid with the white teeth and the suspicious tan. Maybe it was Chuck's lucky blue jacket. Maybe they flipped a coin. I don't know. But in the end, I was chosen to host No Relation. We shot 40 episodes that summer on the same stage as The Price is Right. I shared a dressing room with Bob Barker. Not at the same time, naturally. We might have shot another season, but No Relation was canceled, just as I had predicted, thanks to a revolving door of dim-witted celebrities who lacked the wherewithal to root out imposters. I wound up giving away our entire allotment of grand prizes before the first 10 episodes had even aired. Tom Frank was beside himself. To this day, he refers to the show as Hola Acapulco, which was where all our contestants ended up going. I sometimes wonder if No Relation would have been a hit if Dick Clark had hosted as well as produced it. I bet he could have steered those dim-witted celebrities in the right direction. He was, after all, a master broadcaster, a host who was really a guest who'd come to me as a ghost on my television, who always seemed happy to see me, even though I knew he could not. As for Tom Frank, he might not be the biggest name in town, but he's done okay. So, too, has the kid with the white teeth and the suspicious tan, a kid named Ryan, who missed out on No Relation and wound up saddled with a steady gig he just can't seem to escape on a little show called American Idol. Chapter 31. Bobby Brings Home the Bacon. At the Grammy Awards, Britney Spears forgot to thank the pig. No one called her on it, but looking back, the facts are clear. Without that pig, Britney would have never sold 100 million albums. No way. Likewise, Steven Spielberg would have never gotten Jurassic Park to the big screen, and Neil Armstrong would have never walked on the moon. Yet, none of these people ever acknowledged the pig. Bobby, on the other hand, he thought about that pig every day. Why wouldn't he? Thanks to the pig, Bobby died with a net worth of $3.2 billion and a product that had changed everything. Fundamentally, Bobby was a tinkerer and a risk-taker, but not necessarily in that order. When he was 12, he built a box kite, strapped it to his back, and dove off the roof of Grinnell College in Iowa just to see if he could fly. Turned out, he could, for about 30 seconds. There was also the time he took a propeller, welded it to the back of his sled, and hooked it up to an engine from an old washing machine. Turned out, motorized sleds don't fly either, but they do go faster than normal sleds. Much faster. Bobby was a tinkerer, you see. A risk-taker. But not necessarily in that order. And not just as a boy. When he was 21, he volunteered to procure the guest of honor for a fraternity luau. Under the light of a harvest moon, low and fat in the Iowa sky, the young physics major regarded his options, grunting and rooting around in the muddy pig pen. There were so many to choose from. The farmer wouldn't miss just one swine, would he? Not 12 hours later, the guest of honor was turning slowly over an open fire, roasting to a crispy golden brown with an apple wedged in its mouth. By all accounts, it was a very successful luau. But the next day, a moral hangover weighed heavily upon Bobby. What had he been thinking? The pig had not been his to take, and yet he had taken it. As the son of a preacher, he should have known better. And so Bobby returned to the burgled pig pen, confessed his crime to the farmer, and offered to compensate him. If the farmer had let bygones be bygones, who knows what our world would look like today. But of course, the farmer didn't, because stealing a pig in Iowa back in 1948 was like rustling cattle in Colorado 100 years earlier. It was larceny, especially in Grinnell, where any physics major could have told you that every action had an equal and opposite reaction. Like the good Christian he was, the farmer forgave Bobby's sin. But he still had to press charges. Even though the sheriff liked Bobby, he still had to arrest him. Even though the dean of the college admired Bobby, he still had to expel him. As for the preacher, who loved his son, well, there was nothing he could say in the face of such obvious guilt, and so he said nothing. But not everyone believed that the reaction to Bobby's crime had been equal or opposite or even just. Grant Gale, a physics professor at Grinnell College, came to Bobby's defense. He implored the dean, the sheriff, the mayor, and all the good people in town to rethink the penalty for purloined pork and find a punishment that fit the crime. In the end, the farmer dropped the charges. The sheriff backed off, and Bobby's expulsion was reduced to a one-semester suspension. For some students, that might have translated into a 4-month vacation, but not for Bobby, because in the midst of Grinnell's great swine scandal, Professor Gale had received a very interesting package in the mail, a package that contained 2 prototypes from Bell Laboratories sent to him by a Grinnell graduate. The professor was intrigued. He used one of the prototypes to demonstrate the flow of electrons through a solid in what turned out to be the very first college class ever offered in solid-state electronics. And the other prototype? That wound up in the hands of a suspended senior who liked to tinker and take risks, but not necessarily in that order. You see, if Bobby hadn't spent endless hours tinkering with that prototype, the first transistor produced by Bell Labs, there would have been no small step for Neil Armstrong, because Apollo 11 would not have had an onboard computer. For Steven Spielberg, there would have been no Jurassic Park, because there would have been no computer-generated imagery. And for Britney Spears, there would have been no Grammy Awards, because there would have been no auto-tune. The exact details of how Bobby transformed the modern age would fill a book best written by a physicist, or someone who really understands how the universe works. But this much can be explained by me. Without Bobby's willingness to assume risks, all of his tinkering would have been for naught. Because if you think diving off a roof strapped to a homemade kite is risky, try launching a startup in Silicon Valley before the silicon's even there. That's exactly what Bobby did back in 1968, and even though you might not know his name, you know what's inside. Inside your coffee machine, your electric razor, your car, your remote control, your kid's favorite toy, your Fitbit, your laptop, and of course the smartphone you can't leave home without. It's the very same thing that Bobby was tinkering with during his fortuitous suspension from college. The same thing they're still tinkering with today at a company called Intel. That's the legacy of Robert Noyce, a man who liked to tinker and take risks, but not necessarily in that order. But let's not forget Bob's silent partner, a 25-pound suckling pig whose impact on our lives began with the brief appearance at a long-forgotten luau in America's heartland. A pig whose sacrifice gave us a tiny piece of silicon we call the microchip. Forty years after Robert Noyce put a pig on a spit and transformed the world, 1 year before I put a pig on a pedestal and transformed my blue jeans, another Robert was doing things with pigs that could not be ignored. And so, they weren't. This Robert became the most popular character we ever featured on Dirty Jobs, and those pigs of his, they finished the job that legions of tourists and gamblers could not. For 50 years, Bob Combs drove his ancient pickup truck up and down the Las Vegas Strip, loaded it up with uneaten buffet food from high-end hotels and casinos, and returned to his modest farm in North Las Vegas. There, in an otherwise normal backyard, he shoveled the spoils into his massive cooker, a towering Rube Goldbergian contrivance that transported the smorgasbord into a giant stew pot located three stories above the ground. It wasn't high-tech, but it worked. Before long, the grub was reduced to a viscous, beigey bouillabaisse. Bob told my field producer, Barsky, that the smell reminded him of a bakery. He'd built the entire contraption himself with parts cobbled together from local junkyards. And so, tons of uneaten people food, waste that would have wound up in the landfill, ended up filling the troughs on his farm. Thanks to Bob, a city that traffics in excess, suddenly had a conservation program worth bragging about. I accompanied Bob as he drove that ancient pickup truck down from the cooker to the troughs, with boiling slop sloshing over the roof, down the windshield, and onto the hood. Barsky's eyes widened as hundreds of ravenous pigs descended upon the leftovers. I can still hear the crescendo of squealing and slurping that accompanied this wild and gluttonous scene. It was epic. Just epic. To this day, people ask me about Bob Combs. I tell them that he was a cross between Jimmy Stewart and Old MacDonald, the living embodiment of everything Dirty Jobs had set out to highlight. A modest, good-humored man armed with an extraordinary work ethic. A man who had found a new angle and thrived in a business with very tight margins. As grain prices rose, squeezing all of the farmers around him, Bob kept drawing from his endless supply of leftovers. It was hard work, to be sure, but it was good for his business, good for the environment, and very good for the city of Las Vegas. But when we first met in 2006, Bob was a man besieged by an army of angry acronyms, HSUS, EPA, OSHA, as well as his neighbors who wanted to close his operation down because his pig farm smelled like a pig farm. Las Vegas was booming, and a pig farm wasn't what hundreds of homeowners wanted so close to their brand new homes. They didn't care that Bob had been there for decades. They didn't care that Bob was providing a valuable service. The only thing they cared about was the smell and making it go away. Developers fumed, committees formed, petitions were circulated, and hearings were held. The pressure to close down Bob's farm was unrelenting, but Bob held fast, and I'm glad he did, because after that Dirty Jobs episode aired, the developers tried a different tack. They pulled their resources and offered to buy Bob's property. They offered him a staggering sum, $75 million. Bob passed. "Bob," I said, "what are you thinking? It's $75 million. Bob replied, "Yeah, but what would I do with my pigs?" "I don't know," I said. "Kill them? Eat them? You're going to do that anyway, right?" Bob didn't have anything to say to that, but it occurred to me later that his real question wasn't, "What would I do with my pigs?" It was, "What would I do without them?" Bob Combs had put his pigs on a pedestal years before I came along. He knew what mattered most to him. It was the work, you see. Work that would have ceased had he taken the money. Work that defined him, even though he was approaching his 80th year. Work that he was simply not ready to abandon. "I kind of like the smell," he told me. "I guess I've gotten used to it." Chapter 32. The Grease Man Cometh. The Grease Man